This episode is sponsored by Paleo Valley's pasture-raised chicken sticks. I'm super excited to share Paleo Valley's brand new pasture-raised chicken sticks. These chicken sticks are made from 100% pasture-raised chicken and organic spices that are preserved using natural fermentation rather than preservatives. So yes, no fake stuff or additives here. These chicken sticks are sourced from regenerative family farms raised on American pastures, and each stick is free of chemicals, antibiotics, pesticides, and added hormones. Paleo Valley's chicken sticks are a perfect snack packed with 7 grams of protein and, frankly, a great value without skimping on quality. Make sure to support this podcast and head over to paleovalley.com/NWJ and use code NWJ to get 15% off your order. Thanks again for listening and supporting this podcast. There's always so much talk about corruption these days. It's good that we are waking up to realize that maybe big food, big pharma, big every other corporation does not have the best interest at heart for the average human or person. We also hear about all the nutritional studies. There are so many studies. One study says that eating olive oil is good, and another study says that olive oil is all tainted with seed oils. There are studies that say meat causes heart disease. And then there are other studies that say fructose is good or fructose is bad. So what is it? As an average American, we just want to know what is good to eat, what will make us healthier so that we're making smarter decisions to make our family's health better and our children's health better for the long run. But sometimes truth is a little bit more insidious than we know. There is a reason why there is so much effort and money being pulled into scientific studies on food and what foods are the best for human health. In this conversation, we talk about all these nuances, what really goes on behind scenes. And regardless of the intent and motive and what's the conspiracy theory or just theory, it doesn't matter. What really matters is our outcomes of what's going on with our human population, what's going on with Americans, and the chronic illness that we can actually turn around if we start working together and trying to find solutions for the long run. Thanks for joining me today. My name is Judy Cho, and I'm board certified in holistic nutrition. And I have a private practice where we focus on root cause healing, and that often starts with the Carnivore Cures All Meat Elimination Diet. Today, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Callie Means. He has an amazing story of how he used to work at Coca-Cola, how he used to work with the different policymakers to get funding for certain foods, certain policies, and to really basically make money for big food, big pharma. You'll hear a lot of his story. And I even asked, you know, why is he even sharing? And he shares a little bit about his personal journey as well. It is very eye-opening. And he really candidly shares, maybe we shouldn't be focused so much on research studies and what does evidence-based research say exactly with food? Because if we understand the nuances, those studies were never meant for us to then find the answers of what foods to eat. But in fact, it's bringing confusion so that then policymakers could do whatever they want with our food and our dietary guidelines. Let's get right into the interview. Hi, Callie. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've watched a few of your interviews. I'm super excited to just dive into all of the work that you do and the advocacy you share, your company, your upcoming book. So I'm super excited if you could introduce yourself to the people that are listening and watching.
Thank you so much, Judy. So pumped to be here. My name's Callie Means. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., and thought I was going to be in politics my whole life. I was indoctrinated with that very early, but went to Stanford, studied political science and economics, worked on campaigns while in college and after. And working on campaigns, I quickly learned when they're over, people from the right and the left, everyone goes and becomes consultants or lobbyists. And inevitably for the largest spenders in DC, which are number one by far, pharma. Pharma spends 5 times more on lobbying and public affairs than the oil industry, which we hear a lot about. They're the largest spender by far. And then the second biggest is food. And I found myself across the table helping, you know, this is back 12 years ago, helping the pharmaceutical industry make sure opioids were prescribed, and then helping the food industry like Coca-Cola make sure government money went to processed food. I actually helped Coca-Cola make sure that food stamp spending continued to go to soda. It's to this day, 10% of all SNAP food stamp spending, you know, nutrition sustenance for low income people goes to soda and sugary drinks. And I actually had a systematic strategy to keep policies like that in place, bit lobbying on agriculture subsidies. Today, we subsidize the U.S. government cigarettes more than fruits and vegetables. Almost nothing to pasteurize meat or meat that's good for us. 95%, goes to the components of ultra processed food, the subsidies, and actually tobacco. So helped on those items. Got out of that world, went to business school, became an entrepreneur. And just to kind of close the story real quick and can go wherever you want. But a couple life experiences helped me look back on those days working for food and pharma and really reassess them. One was my sister, who was the pride of the family. We were very traditional. Like she went to med school, Stanford, surgeon. We were all proud of her. She dropped out after really feeling like she was being pushed to do interventions that weren't necessary, and really awakening that she did not take one nutrition class in med school, like 90% of doctors that graduate, and really didn't understand why her patients were sick. So she, Dr. Casey Means, who went on to start some successful companies in metabolic health and be an outspoken advocate, had a huge impact on me. And then the last thing, a couple of years ago, as I was being awoken to health incentives by my sister, our mom, our best friend, who seemed perfectly healthy, was abruptly, unexpectedly diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. The day of that diagnosis, we thought she was perfectly healthy. 13 days later, she was dead. And unwinding that experience, where the oncologist, again, at Stanford Med School, some of the highest rated oncologists in the country, said that this was a tough break and unlucky. Unwinding that and really realizing that cancer wasn't unlucky. She was on 6 medications over 40 years. She dealt with obesity. She was on the metformin for high blood sugar. She was on the statins for high cholesterol. She was on the ACE inhibitor for high blood pressure. These are rites of passages for the Americans, just kind of siloed chronic diseases going up the chain. And what I've put together and what I'm devoting my life to is that there's a real incentive for us to get sick. And then companies, pharma, hospitals, med schools, they make money when we're sick. So you have the medical system silent on the reason we're getting sick, just accepting the fact that we're getting sick.
Right.
And the reason we're getting sick is actually very simple. It's because of food and metabolic habits. But there's a systematic effort to complicate that in our minds and segment diseases and have the medical system as a savior. So I'm really trying to unwind that and make sure what happened to my mom, which is happening to millions of people, kind of the small things leading to the big things, trying to make sure that doesn't happen.
Do you think, first of all, thank you so much for sharing your story. My parents were also on a lot of those medications. And so I'm really grateful that, in a sense, my health just crashed earlier.
Right.
And I learned about, okay, maybe a lot of these standard interventions aren't the answer. And then when it worked for me, I just forced it on my parents. And luckily, they were willing to listen. And so they're in their 70s on zero medications, which pharma does not love and insurance does not love. So thank you again. So I fully get it. And my parents were also obese and they were taking the metformins and the cholesterol reducing medication, et cetera, et cetera. It's the standard, like you said, rite of passage in terms of the medication. And never once do they really talk about food, just maybe swap a few of the breads for maybe some brown rice or something like that. That's the extent that I hear from the education of Kaiser Permanente that they told my mother. But given all of this, is it because the part that I always struggle with in my mind is a lot of this, are there evils in this? Or is it just that this thing has become so big and now it's just, I'll pat your back, you pat mine. And then there's all these agreements and money's exchanged. Or is it more diabolical that I know there's some thoughts where they intentionally poisoned our foods, intentionally poisoned us to make us sick and then make pharma richer. But if you have any thoughts on, what bigger picture of this is.
It's a key question that I think about and struggle with a lot. Something that's in my mind a lot, I've read a book on kind of organizational design and it says, it's really actually just not really, there's not much value in asking about motivations. Mm-hmm. I do it a lot. I want to address this because I think it's very important for people to get their head around. But the key thing is to ask what a system does. just like the, what it produces is the desired result. So it's almost like we have our trouble wrapping around our heads around how people could be so evil when you look at the fact that we're spending $4 trillion and people are getting sick, and this idea that the system is incentivized for us to be sick. It really does sound like a conspiracy. It sounds evil. I think the genius of the medical system is that it's so large and the invisible hand of incentives has developed a system that's, again, it's the largest industry in the country and the fastest growing. It's the most, and you know, more people are employed by this industry than any other industry. So it's bigger than any one person. And through the invisible hand, it's been built to grow. And the genius of the organizational design of the system is that it's what it's producing is evil. And we can go into that more, but I think unabashedly, it is evil. We're spending more and more money and people are getting fatter, more depressed, more infertile and sicker. Life expectancy is actually going down. Each dollar we spend, people get sicker. There's never been a chronic disease drug in history that has lowered rates of the chronic disease it's trying to treat. Statins result in more heart disease. Cancer treatments result in more cancer. SSRIs result in more depression. Ozempic, JP Morgan, when they're estimating actually obesity rates over the next 10 years, they estimate that obesity rates are going to rise. Why is that? Why are we estimating obesity rates are going to rise as more people get Ozempic? This is what happens with every single drug. They're actually incentivize people to be more sick and manage their condition. So that's an evil system. The genius of the organizational design is it takes good people and gives them plausible deniability. So we all know doctors and they're all good people. We know people that work, many of my friends in business school work at pharmaceutical companies, work at food companies, work at Coke, work at Pepsi. So I think throughout history, you've seen this, the most evil systems can take millions of people that are good, that have studied at medical school and come to this country to be doctors and heal people for the right reasons and put them into a system and then produce bad results. So every doctor on a micro level, you know, is trying to do the right thing. But if you talk to doctors, quite frankly, you know, you see that they know they're in a system that's not making patients better, that's really putting band-aids over what's clearly a geyser of metabolic dysfunction that we're not solving. You actually look at doctors, the dropout rate, the burnout rate, the suicide rate is the highest among any profession. The New York Times actually did an article where they likened it to soldiers who are forced to commit war crimes. There's actually a mental health epidemic among doctors that's a similar trait where it's like good soldiers come in for the right reasons and then their superiors force them basically to do things that they know are wrong. So this is happening in the medical system. I think people are waking up. I do put some moral culpability, quite frankly, on doctors, on executives at these companies for not speaking out about the fact that they're participating in an industry that's fundamentally making people sicker. But I think that's the key, the invisible hands of incentives, the invisible hand of the incentives of the largest and fastest growing and most employed industry in the country is producing bad things by taking good people and putting them into that system. Again, I don't think for the most part, the CEO of a pharmaceutical company, the dean of a medical school, the head of a hospital, doctors, they're not evil people. But I do think at some point in time, we need more leadership from leaders to talk about that the problem with healthcare isn't that we don't have the right kind of marginal policy on the Medicare law or, you know, this kind of these tired debates between the left and right. The problem with medicine is that every single industry, every single part of the industry, right, from medical schools to hospitals, to pharmaceutical companies, make more money when more people are sick and lose money when people are healthier. And unless you attack that incentive, we have a huge problem. I mean, I would actually pray and hope that the dean of Harvard Med School and the head of Pfizer and the head of the NIH went to Congress tomorrow and said, you know, we've got to steer medical dollars to incentivizing a better food system, incentivizing movement among children, incentivizing, you know, better mental health, the components of metabolic health. They have the ability to do that and actually paint a vision for a healthcare system that attacks the root cause. But of course, they don't because that would lose trillions of dollars.
Yeah, no, I think you really nailed it on the head with it doesn't matter why, if it's intentionally evil or not, what really matters is the outcome. And so I think instead of wasting time in a sense on what's the ultimate driver, what's the intent or the motive, it's really about whatever it is, the outcome is negative and it's affecting us. And I think that's more important to focus on. And so what's the solve? How do we fix this? And I heard you say that America's biggest scandal has something to do with the nutritional guidelines, food, pharma being all tied together. So maybe if you could just explain and expand on why do you think it's the biggest scandal?
Yeah, I think the largest issue in the country is that we are getting sicker. And as I said, more depressed, more infertile, and more overweight. And, you know, we our eyes gloss over with all the statistics, but I do think this is like something you see whenever you go into a classroom. It's like, the amount of obesity, the amount of developmental issues, the amount of mental health issues among kids. It's not normal. You talk to anybody, this is not normal. We're really facing a crisis. Then you get to adults, you know, where I think at last count, it's close to 66% have some degree of a range of prediabetes or more. You know, 80% at this point are overweight or obese. There's something like fundamentally wrong happening to our health. And I think from a public policy or societal issue, that's the most important issue, clearly, because it's our brains and bodies. It's the baseline to everything. But we're getting sicker. And the medical industry, I think, is obfuscating why we're getting sicker. I think it's actually obvious that it's very simple. What has changed in the last 30 years? It's an attack on our metabolism. It's the rise of ultra-processed food. It's the rise of chronic stress. It's the rise of sedentary behavior, where now only 20% of 21-year-olds are eligible to join the military. It, you know, there's actually been an attack on sleep. We get 2 hours less sleep than we did 80 years ago. So it's like they're actually just the core, like, foundational biological needs of our body have been kind of systematically under attack. Environmental toxins is another one. But you can kind of, from a societal perspective, attack those things and talk about those things. And there's actually, like, I think, really simple things we can do to, like, encourage movement, encourage sleep, most importantly, encourage a better food system. Like, this could be changed very quickly. Other countries, frankly, are doing it and have dramatically higher results. Again, the handshake is the devil's bargain, though. And this, and I'll dive in a little bit to what I saw, is that not only do you not have the medical system speaking out about our food system, they're actually are in cahoots. While I was working for processed food companies in Coca-Cola, I actually funneled money from Coke to the American Diabetes Association. I helped engineer a partnership in 2010. So you can't even wrap your head around it. The American Diabetes Association, which we would all expect, be advocating for lowering diabetes rates. That's not their role. They're a subsidiary of pharmaceutical companies that make more money when more people get diabetes. So they actually accepted money from what I call diabetes water, Coke. Liquid sugar is a weapon of mass destruction for blood sugar levels. They actually take money from ultra-processed food companies. The American Diabetes Association on their website said small cans of full sugar Coke might be a good idea for diabetics. They also gave guidance until 2018, when they were shamed to adjust it slightly, that as long as you took your drugs as a diabetic, you could eat whatever you wanted. You could continue eating as much sugar as you wanted, any food. That was literally the guidance of the American Diabetes Association, again, who took money from ultra-processed food companies. So you have this, like, complete and utter willful blind spot of nutrition, to where my sister was reprimanded at Stanford Med School for suggesting a nutritional intervention to one of her patients who had such bad sinus inflammation that they had to give her a sinusitis surgery and cut open their sinuses. This idea of nutrition and metabolic habits being soft and pills and surgical interventions being real medicine, that's endemic in the industry, which I think is a huge problem.
Yeah, you had mentioned the soda thing. Like, how does that happen? So I think you mentioned that a dollar amount of how much soda then is covered by, like, the SNAP program. And if maybe right. You could just briefly explain what SNAP program is and how does it even happen? Because just from a face value, that sounds crazy for anybody. Like, most people know soda is bad for you. So how do they allow that? And then why do they allow that in the SNAP program?
Yeah, it's this complicated web. So working, you know, for the food companies, you know, in the morning, we'll have meetings on research strategy. So the food industry spends 11 times more on funding nutrition research than the NIH. So you've had 50,000 nutrition studies on PubMed produced in the last 2 years, almost all funded by food companies. And what I learned is that nutrition research is, I think, nothing more than public relations for ultra-processed food. You don't need a ton of nutrition studies to tell us to eat natural, non-ultra-processed, non-glyphosate-laden food. The only point of nutrition research is to say that glyphosate is okay, is to say that sugar is okay, is to say, as the USDA recently said, that a diet 91% in ultra-processed food is healthy. That's the point of nutrition. So the food industry spending tens of billions of dollars on nutrition research isn't for some, you know, desire to advance unbiased scholarship. It's to get those studies. And then those studies then go to Congress and then are used by lobbyists to impact regulations. So it sounds ridiculous. It sounds completely ridiculous. But there are still studies today from leading institutions questioning whether sugar causes obesity. We used those like crazy 10 years ago to say, no, the science is wrong. A calorie is a calorie. Coca-Cola is something that these poor kids like to drink. It's a cheap source of calories. Here's 50 studies. So when you see these news reports on like the recent Tufts study that says Lucky Charms are healthier than beef, it sounds so ridiculous and funny, but it's not funny because those studies are then used to influence these policies. So you bombard the regulators with the studies. And that's why I think nutrition research schools, Harvard, Tufts, on down, very prominent institutions where every professor at that school is on the payroll of food companies and the school exists because of food companies. That's a real problem. And that's how that connects. Yeah. And then I just say real quick with the academia, it's food companies being the lifeblood of nutrition funding, and they do consulting payments. And then there's pushes to get those professors who are compromised to make guidelines and policies. So the USDA guidelines, which set the standard, I mean, you know, nobody's questioning that. That's the guardrails of how we operate. The USDA guidelines, there were 20 members of the most recent panel. 19 of them have been directly paid by food and or pharma companies. And then the USDA guidelines that we are living under today, the ones that exist today, say that a two-year-old can have up to 10% of their diet as added sugar, which is crazy, which is criminal. So it's the research connecting to the policy is I think where that really hits the road.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing from you is that they don't necessarily care what public sees of the papers. Now, it may facilitate certain people that advocate for sugar, or like the balanced diets or Mediterranean diets or any of those, the typical registered dietitian that has been sponsored, you know, their school has been sponsored by the soda companies. But it's ultimately, if they have these papers out that then validate that sugar is not bad or in moderation, then they can have, so therefore, because of the study, now maybe we support the nutrition guidelines, and then that's how the funding can go that way because the paper said so. Would that?
Yeah, exactly. The point is confusion itself, right? The point isn't even to win the argument. There's a database of internal documents from the cigarette industry in the 1970s. And one of the largest, or I think the largest PR firm that I worked at for a little bit, was the lead PR firm for cigarette companies. And the strategy in these leaked memos from the 70s was very clear. It's not even to win the argument, it's to seed confusion. And all of the lobbyists, all of the public relations professionals, all the scientists from the cigarette companies, as that industry declined in the 1980s, went to food companies. And now they're the largest spender, I think the largest drug peddler, quite frankly, in the country. And the express purpose, this isn't rocket science, right? Sitting in DC with the strategists and lobbyists, these aren't genius people, but they know that if you can seed doubt and go to a member of Congress, you know, whose main issue is not nutrition, who's, you know, on a military guy that's, you know, that kind of just defers, has to defer to some things, and you pound them with a ton of studies and say it's confusing and say to trust the experts, they're pretty much going to relent, particularly when you back it up with a bunch of threats. You're going to lobby and advertise against them and say that they're anti-science if they disagree. They're just choosing to kind of forego that battle. I've heard from member of Congress after member of Congress. I've met with close to 50 in the past year. They're like, I'm not a nutrition expert. I've got to just defer. It's not my issue. That's the general prevailing sentiment. So that's why I think this corruption of research is so dangerous. And it's joint. It's the revolving door. You know, it's like the head of the USDA goes to the food companies. It's that just as the head of the FDA is now on the board of Pfizer. It's this revolving door. And back scratching, you know, the NIH itself isn't really, it's not really bureaucrats working at the NIH. They're a grant making organization. And it's just a revolving door of people from industry coming to the NIH, making the grants to the industry. You know, and 80% of NIH grants have a conflict of interest, you know, to nutrition or pharma. So that's what you have. And yeah, I would just say research was a massive tool of the lobbyists in public relations. And you need to see any nutrition study that says something that like manifestly doesn't seem to make sense. You've got to ask why. It's to confuse the issue. It's also to go, frankly, to school boards. The largest source of calories that kids get is, you know, federally funded school lunches. And there's no sugar limit. There's no caps on or really guidelines on any nutrition. Kraft recently said that their biggest growth area as a company is the billions of dollars they expect to make now that Lunchables is considered a vegetable at schools and is now officially partnered with the U.S. government to be a healthy food in schools, Lunchables. That all derives from nutrition confusing this, that basically saying that ultra-processed food is fine.
Hey guys, just to let you know, my Carnivore Cure book is back in stock. For 9 months, it was out of print and used prices were up to $300. Make sure to get your copy today that has over 200 colored tables and graphics and over 400 pages of meaty goodness. We have a limited supply, so get your copy today on Amazon.com. And if you can leave a review, I'd be super grateful. Yeah, it was really interesting. So I was doing research on lunches from the 650s and all the way down. And now they, at a certain point, because cost was becoming too exorbitant for, I guess, fruits and vegetables, they started counting ketchup, which has a lot of sugar in it, as a vegetable or a fruit. And it's insane. What's so frustrating for me in the nutrition space is I'll get so many arguments from people that are super into fruits or sugars, or, and they'll cite a lot of the studies that are fructose is not that bad. Here's so many studies that show fructose is not bad. And then when I dig deeper enough, because the headlines, the results, everything sounds legit. And then you look and the sponsorship was from a Coca-Cola company.
Right.
And it's just, but no one cares to look that deep. And you're right. So it does bring confusion, because then I always get, hey, Judy, argue this study. This study shows that fructose is actually not bad. It is hard, because then it's, we're always combating, and who's going to spend money on proving that pasture-raised meats reducing ultra-processed carbs is actually healthy for you. And if anything, they have studies where they'll feed rats. They'll define it as high-fat diet. And if you look at the actual feed they feed the rat, it's like 60% fat, but there's still carbohydrates, lots of seed oils, everything is super processed. So then from a person that's on a ketogenic diet, as an example, they'll see that study and say, oh my gosh, high fat diets are bad. But if you actually look at the literature, it's not a keto or a carnivore diet, and it's just rampant.
Yeah. So I think you're bringing up a really interesting point of kind of this evidence-based community, you know, and the countless hours of podcasts where people are poring over studies and, and breathlessly reporting that study, next study. So couple thoughts on that. First off, a lot of these folks are great people, and these evidence-based podcasts that go deeply through the research have impacted me. And I know there's a lot of good, rigorous people pushing to have health go in the right direction as they see it. So I just want to say that I think we're all in the fights in different ways. I would just say that I think it's dangerous to fetishize the peer-reviewed research too much, because that research, what's missing from that is who's funding the research and what the point of that research is. And I can tell you from the person that funded that research, sitting with pharmaceutical companies and food companies, it is very unimpressive people, right, who are funding that research for a very clear reason. Like Coke is funding a study on fruit to then say that fructose is fine, right? And to then badger school boards to say that serving five-year-olds highly sugar-laden drinks is okay. And it's kind of like missing the point, right? I think what's missing from that is that there's really a simple principle for food and for health, which is that if you could take ultra-processed food consumption down from 60-65% as it is today to 20% like it is more in Japan, we would have a transformation of American human capital. We would save trillions of dollars of healthcare costs. We would explode life expectancy upwards. Like you literally could just have like simple, and I think it all derives to ultra processed food. You know, there's the whole calorie is a calorie debate, which I in my opinion has been settled, and a calorie is not a calorie. But even if you accept that, the food is weaponized. The food is, ultra-processed food is a science experiment to make it more palatable, to make it more addictive. That's the problem with ultra-processed food. As I said, thousands of scientists in the 80s and 90s went from cigarette companies to food companies. Food companies are one of the largest employers of scientists in the world. There are tens of thousands working on science experiments to make ultra-processed food to hack our brains. And yeah, funding the research that's talked about, you know, and kind of scrutinized study by study, That's the point of why food companies, they want to see confusion. They want to see just a little bit of doubt that maybe ultra processed food is okay. I would argue just for really up-leveling this debate, realizing that the problem is actually the nutrition research itself. We're the only animals and humans and animals we've domesticated that have chronic metabolic dysfunction, that have rampant rates of obesity. Every single animal in the wild, every single animal that's ever existed throughout human history has never had a problem with metabolic dysfunction, has never had a problem with obesity. They didn't have experts telling them what to eat, telling them the ultra-processed food was okay. So, you know, a wolf in the wild has a 1% depression rate by any measure. A dog that's domesticated with humans has a 60% depression rate. I think we're losing track with our common sense by relying on nutrition research, quite frankly. And there's like a spiritual element to this where we have been taken away from an innate understanding of what's good for us, which is obviously, I think, natural food. And I think we kind of need to break free when it comes to nutrition research.
Yeah, I do agree with that. So a lot of times I try to bring in the common sense with a lot of the wellness stuff. People will say, well, if I eat like conventionally raised animals, then they're not good for me. So therefore you go back to eating processed foods. There's a lot of fear even in the wellness space. So then, and people use studies. And again, there's a lot of that confusion. And sometimes, so we'll get, just to give you some context of what I'm saying, in the carnivore space, we tend to see blood sugar go up a little bit, but insulin is normalized. And so then people start getting fear-mongered a little bit of the non-carnivore groups or the non-keto groups of, see, it's a bad diet. Your blood sugar is going up. And then standard care will also look at the blood sugar and say, oh, your blood sugar's gone up from last time. What are you doing? Like, are you eating a lot of sugar? And the answer is no, I'm just eating meat. And then, well, there's something wrong with you metabolically. And innate wisdom would say, well, my blood sugar is going up, but I'm not eating any sugar. So maybe it's not an issue. But most people will focus on the studies and the concerns and no, my blood sugar is going up. So therefore this diet is bad, but there's a lot of nuance. It could be that your red blood cells are living longer. I found a study where dolphins that are eating mostly carnivore, that their blood sugar is generally on the higher end too. So maybe it's just a natural human or bodily response from a mammals. And I think instead we then get scared. We ignore our intuition where we feel better on eating a cleaner diet. And then we go back to, but the studies, the doctors, this and that say, and then we just make it really confusing for the average person. And then instead it just becomes easier. I'm just going to eat whatever, because I don't know what the right diet or answer is.
That's the goal. Oh, absolutely. I think a spiritual attack on people to take leave of their sanity and common sense. I'd say even for what you're saying, that exploration you just said, there's a way every human could be encouraged to be in that exploration, to have curiosity about their biomarkers. Yeah, I mean, I think blood sugar is a nice shorthand, a problematic but very useful shorthand for metabolic dysfunction. It's one of them.
Right.
But if your insulin levels are stable and positive, your blood sugar is a little high and you have a reason, then that's an interesting exploration, right? The blood sugar is not, it really is a proxy for insulin. This is the really important thing with insulin resistance. So if you can actually measure your insulin, which you can and which should be standard and is actually a better measurement, then that's a really interesting data point. But even what you're explaining, right, of getting on this path of exploring the carnivore diet, of comparing and really analyzing your metabolic biomarkers, that's like 1% of people are doing that right now. You know, 99% of people are getting their labs and, you know, they're in the right range, even though it's most of the time actually indicating metabolic dysfunction. The algorithm says it's okay. They're told it's okay. One time I actually had, you know, about 2 years ago, slightly elevated triglycerides, fasting glucose, like slightly elevated, not at the treatable range. This had a huge impact on me. And I asked my doctor, I'm like, doesn't this suggest underlying metabolic dysfunction? Oh yeah, definitely. But it's not treatable yet. They said, it's not treatable yet. You're not at the arbitrary marker where we will prescribe you a statin or prescribe you metformin. So they literally, like, and you see this everywhere, even, you know, good hospital systems, unless you are ready to prescribe a statin,
right,
you're okay. So I don't take a side too strongly in all the the diet tribes. I've definitely been getting, our son is almost entirely carnivore. I've been going much more to that level. What I say is that anyone that goes on this journey of exploration is on a good track. Right. You know, try something out. And I'll tell you, there's nothing worse than what we're doing now in our standard level. You know, there's just something I saw online. It's like, you know, doctors are saying the ultra processed food is fine, but no, you can't eat meat. You can't eat mostly. It's like, whatever we do, any exploration we want to take, I guarantee you is better than the standard American diet. And as you've evolved, you go vegan, you realize that's not where you evolve. Getting on a path of exploration is a very good thing. And my point is that the industry is trying to get people out of any type of empowerment. They're trying to scare people.
Right.
And then at a public policy level, you actually can really incentivize people to be on that path. You know, often what the medical community does is they say, maybe whole food is better, but that's too expensive. It's not practical. It's not their job to, you know, scare people out of what's practical. It's their job to follow the science. Sure. And if the medical community said whole food is good and actually follow the science, then there's actually public policy to incentivize better food. There's public policy to make more blood tests like insulin available, to make it more standard, to have people understand that if they have spiking insulin or triglycerides or frankly obesity or HDL, you know, understanding their metabolic health indicators and actually warning them and actually showing them what's going to happen if they don't get those under a certain level. Like, we don't do that right now. We don't empower people with actionable information and incentivize the right things, which we could do very quickly.
Right. It's lack of critical thinking, I think, across all systems. So even doctors, because they're so busy, because they're meeting people every 7 or 15 minutes, they just go by, okay, there's no H or no L next to your blood marker. And so therefore you're fine. My mom, when we were reducing her metformin with on a carnivore diet, it was at 110. And the doctor's like, oh, your labs are beautiful. And it's like, no, that's pre-diabetes.
110's very high.
Beautiful, and you still need to reduce that. And it's exactly right. So whether it's schools, like, I have to follow the rules. I was talking to a friend of mine that's a teacher in Los Angeles, and they said, yeah, I have to teach all the gender roles, and I don't even understand it, but I'm just basically parroting what I've been taught. And there's no critical thinking. We just follow the rules, and then we consume ultra processed foods, which makes us tired, which makes us brain foggy. And then it becomes easier to just follow. And the whole reason for those tough food guidelines is now they're going to put, and even the White House nutritional guidelines, they're going to slap stickers on processed foods of this is healthier than that food. And it's like, oh, cool, easy. I'm going to give this to my kid because they say it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of thoughts there. It's just extraordinary that you've gotten your mom off medications.
Neuro meds, 72.
At 72. So my mom at 71, when she got the cancer diagnosis, mm-hmm. she went to a primary care visit a couple months before that. And she was on 6 medications. And her primary care provider said, you're healthy. Great job. She's actually commented. My mom was actually on at 6 medications, was lower than the average 71-year-old. There's something, it's over 10 medications per person are prescribed per year. A lot of that's older people on a ton, but old people in this country, also it goes much younger, are on a ton of medications. And that's now starting very young. I mean, I think it's like 20% of high school seniors are on Adderall and methamphetamine. That's one molecule away from crystal meth. I think it's 15% of high school students are on some kind of mental health medication, prescription medication. Of course, you have the American Academy of Pediatrics saying that Ozempic should be the standard of care for 12 years and up, and now being studied on 6-year-olds, not as an emergency intervention, but actually the first line of defense for any obese or overweight 12-year-old, which is 50% of them. So you have this, again, it's like, what's evil? What's not? What are the motivations? It's like, let's take that aside. Yeah. You've got this like absolute aggressive effort to intervene among kids and train them. I think this is the kind of, I think what the path my mom was on, and I think the path kids are getting on. When you train them to take the statin, and that their high cholesterol is a statin deficiency, which is what they're being told. When you tell them that they're over their weight, and this is coming from Harvard, this is coming from the American Academy of Pediatrics, you are now basically bigoted and fat phobic to say that obesity is the result of personal choice or what we eat. It's a genetic condition. It's a chronic condition. It's just like getting cancer or diabetes. It's like, you know, there's nothing that's in our control. That is what we're hearing from Harvard. And actually that's the predicate that has to be established before you get Medicare, Medicaid funding. So we're getting people on this treadmill. And that's my message to people. When it comes to chronic conditions, if you have an infection, I think we overprescribe antibiotics, but you know, the medical system is a miracle. Like, I would definitely listen to your doctor if you have an emergency childbirth situation or a burst appendix or
broken bone,
an infection that's going to kill you. Or 100%. We are wonderful with that for the most part. The problem is the chronic, and it's just once you start getting on that treadmill, you know, my mom on the statin, you just start getting more. The average diabetic person, I think, has four other comorbidities. So you just start going on this treadmill, which is a real problem and kind of takes you out of the system and takes you out of asking questions for yourself.
Well, you had mentioned that it's worse for people with low income because maybe they're on the SNAP program. A lot of the school lunches, you have to qualify, I think, for a free lunch even. And a lot of the people with lower incomes will rely on that food source. So if you can just sort of tell us, what is that all about? And are they purposely targeting? And maybe it's not the intention, but what is it about the low income, you know, the Lunchables being a food source and all the other things around that with SNAP?
Lower income people is a huge source of money for the healthcare industry because of Medicaid. Okay. When you add up Medicaid and Medicare, we actually spend more on diabetes management as a government than the entire defense budget. Wow. So the healthcare system loves a poor child because the government's going to be paying their health insurance straight to the coffers of the pharmaceutical companies. So if a child gets diabetes at 18, that is an amazing thing for the medical system because that kid's not going to die, right? They're going to have an extremely suboptimal life. They're going to be almost certainly depressed, and they're going to just continue to get comorbidities that are going to torture their lives, but they're not going to die unless they commit suicide, which is the leading cause of death now for Americans under 34, which is skyrocketing.
Right.
I think largely because of this chronic disease and mental health epidemic happening among kids because of metabolic issues. But there's nothing more profitable for the medical system than an 18-year-old diabetic on Medicaid. They're actually, the government's going to be paying pharma companies and medical system millions of dollars from taxpayers over that child's life. They're going to have obviously heart disease issues. They're going to have fertility issues. They're going to have cholesterol, you know, blood pressure issues. They're going to be on everything, right? That kid's going to have every issue you can possibly, and then eventually generate a lot of billings by dying early. So there's this huge incentive to get kids, frankly, on that treadmill. If that kid, of course, learns metabolic healthy habits, or their parents are incentivized to buy natural foods, and there's more incentives to move, that kid is going to cost the medical system millions of dollars, but save taxpayers millions of dollars. So yeah, that's how the system is designed. That's the incentives of the system. Where that leads, which I think high level is evil, but what that leads to is, like, friends of mine, right, who work in pharma, you know, people at Novo Nordics saying that it is absolutely imperative morally to jab Ozempic into kids' arms. They actually maybe have convinced themselves that obesity is an Ozempic deficiency and it's actually somehow going to help to inject this substance into millions of kids. Like, they've somehow been able to make that argument with a straight face, despite the data that there's never been a chronic disease treatment that's ever lowered the rates of chronic disease in history. And they're actually with a straight face arguing that it's morally appropriate for the government to spend $15,000, which is what this costs per person per year, when you could take a fifth of that amount that Ozempic's going to cost the taxpayer, maybe $3,000, and fix our food system. You know, we could fix our food system for a lot less than $15,000 per overweight person per year. But that's just not how people think. And you know, we have this all out assault that everything, you know, is about drug interventions. We're really losing our way. I mean, I do think this is the important issue. This is the existential issue. Like, we're not going to drug our way out of this problem. And I don't know what other people are seeing. I'm seeing human capital really being decimated right now. 25% of women, adults, are on a mental health medication, an SSRI or similar drug that's not not curing anything. You know, all the other stats we've talked about, it's like human capital is being really decimated and we're going to go bankrupt. The cost dynamic here is not a joke. I think we gloss over that a lot, but 20% of GDP growing double the rate of GDP, it's going to be 40% of GDP in 20 years. Health costs, it's not slowing down. So unless that trajectory changes, we are literally just mathematically going to go bankrupt and be this fat, infertile, sick, depressed country, which is really what we're going to. I mean, it sounds hyperbolic, but it is true. Like, we're losing our ability to reproduce at an alarming rate. So yeah, we got to unwind that.
No, I agree. I think if you think of it just more holistically, that's how I'm sure other countries are looking at us becoming really big and sick and unwell and just following whatever is being brought down. And so it's like, wow, it's perfect to take over or, you know, be the next superior power. So it's really unfortunate because I don't think people are processing. You mentioned that SNAP is purposely low.
It's a good point that I wanted to bring up is like the weaponization of kind of class warfare. When we were lobbying for SNAP reform, we purposely lobbied for lower amounts of SNAP contributions so that people could only afford ultra-processed food. And then on the next conversation, argue that it's classist and in some ways even racist to stigmatize food because it's all they could afford.
Right.
So high level, the best thing we could do for the American budget is to get whole food into lower income folks' hands, because when they eat ultra processed food, it causes trillions of dollars of downstream health impacts with the diabetes, the obesity, all the problems. So, but the system's been rigged where on the one hand, food companies are rigging that food stamps are actually low and that we're subsidizing ultra processed food to the point where you go into a supermarket and Coke is less than water because there's so many subsidized ingredients in the Coke. So we create that system and then have the food companies spend millions of dollars funding activists on TikTok to say that anyone who stigmatizes food is a racist because it's all these people, you know, can afford. So you have it both sides of this like weaponizing of the class warfare kind of debate. There's two things I'd say there. From a bottoms up perspective, we should just speak clearly, and scientific leaders are not economic opiners. Their job is to follow the science, and they should be saying very clearly that there's a metabolic health issues among kids. And if you're a parent and you're letting your kid eat the majority of their diet in ultra processed high sugar foods, that kid is going to live a shorter, more tortured life. Almost certainly they're much more likely to be depressed. They're much more likely to be obese. They're going to have other comorbidities. They're going to have trouble procreating. That kid is super. We should just speak plainly about that. Right. It's one of the most, if not the most important thing a parent could do is make sure that their kid grows up with their microbiome is intact and they're metabolically functional, which is what fuels our brain and our bodies and our perception of reality. So there is like, I think there's definitely places where there's just flat out like an inability to afford something. But for the vast majority of American parents, if you can't get your kid non-poison food, you should like move to a smaller house or something. We should speak plainly about it. It's the most important job of a parent to not poison your kids, which is what we're doing at scale.
Right.
So there's the bottoms up, but there's the top down of like public policy wise, this is actually very, very easy to change. I mean, tomorrow the president could do an executive order saying we're not going to fund poison. We're not going to fund soda with food stamps. There could be an executive order tomorrow and a swift action to change agriculture subsidies on school lunches. Frankly, Michelle Obama was right, but she caved quickly to the food companies. And it quite frankly shouldn't have been the first lady talking about school lunches. It should have been the president, the secretary of defense, and the secretary of treasury, because this is a national security issue. And it's also the biggest economic issue we have is our exploding metabolic health crisis and the associated costs. So bottoms up, we need to be clear that this is actually the most important thing we can do for kids. Top down, we need to, and I'm hopeful. I mean, there's a lot of talk about this going into 2024, but we've got to readjust some of these policies.
Yeah. I think the part that we miss is some people are like, well, I don't have kids, so it's not a worry, or I don't have this, or my kids are already grown. It's not but it's if we don't help our kids be educated and fueled correctly, who's going to take over this country and lead it and serve it? And I think that's the part that we are missing when we're like, right, I don't have kids, or the kid stuff doesn't matter, or my kids are not in school. And it's a bigger issue than our own children. And it's part of the reason I advocate Yes, I'm feeding my kids mostly meat-based. They eat other foods because that's that. I don't want them to have an eating disorder. But it's beyond my kids. If my kids are the only healthy ones, why does it matter? How are they going to find a spouse? How are they going to procreate? And so I think it's a bigger systemic issue that we cannot Absolutely. Just think so myopically with my family safe, so then we're good, because it's not. And
it's the highest leverage point in society is what we're doing to our kids' brains and bodies, 100%.
Yeah.
An American, if you have any care for the future of this country, the fact that we are poisoning kids at scale is a problem.
No, I fully agree. And then I wanted to touch really quickly on the mental illness. So I had postpartum, and eventually they put me on antidepressants. Then it didn't work. And then they put me on antipsychotics, and then it wasn't working enough. And so I was that good student. I will listen to my doctor. I want to be a good mom. So therefore I need to listen. And it wasn't working. And so that's why I went down my own rabbit hole. And as you said, there's a lot of women on these antidepressants. Someone recently said, postpartum is very real. And I know it's very real. I do think there's some metabolic imbalances with that, but it is very real. And the solution right now is getting a lot of these women on antidepressants, which I am not sure if is the answer. But you have some stats on some of the antidepressants. Can you share a little bit about, I just think logically, because I saw the numbers of the antidepressants, and a lot of the antidepressants are serotonin uptake inhibitors. So basically, we think it's a serotonin right. issue. And so if we just block the serotonin from leaving the brain, you'll be fine. But right. the reality is that most people use antidepressants. It doesn't work enough. Then they need to add another drug. And Abilify, for example, is $1 billion per year drug. But if it was just truly serotonin, then people would be fixed. But more and more people are getting on antidepressants every single day, and it's not really
working. Right. Yeah. So the first thing I want to say on the postpartum, one of my very best friends suffered severe postpartum depression, was like everyone put on SSRIs. Okay. And she says that they helped for a brief moment of time. I just want to say, because I was inspired by this, she started reading a ton of books by Mark Hyman, by the carnivore community, by Chris Palmer, The Brain Energy, which talks about the metabolic impacts of mental health issues and brain issues. And went off the SSRIs and started going on a journey of really understanding the root cause, and says she's feeling better than she's ever felt in her life by like kind of going on that journey. I'm not reflexively anti-drug at all times. We have to understand that the incentives of SSRIs are an absolute scandal. The mental health community doesn't make money if you can figure out how to take matters into your own hands. SSRIs don't cure anything. When you go off of them, things are the same. That's just study after study. They're a chronic issue, right? And then for the pharma and the therapists and the prescribers of those, there's a real incentive to have you on. I've heard many stories from women who were shamed by their mental health providers for trying to go off of them, because that's a huge cost. There's a huge money loss to the industry. Harvard was recently hosted a mental health conference, and they could not find a professor or doctor who wasn't paid by SSRI makers. The vast majority of folks, doctors who treat mental health, are paid for by SSRI makers. It's a real cancer in the industry. There's real incentive problems. On the science, it's a scandal. SSRIs are a scandal. The entire basis of the research on the chemical imbalance has been actually, in the past year, kind of invalidated. Actually, it's almost been called fraudulent, the fundamental underpinning. And then you have really shocking studies coming out, just study after study. It's being replicated that if you take a depressed population and you give half of them SSRIs and therapy, and then half of them no SSRIs, no therapy, but they eat whole food and work out regularly, consistently the group without therapy and SSRIs does much better outcomes on mental health. What my company TrueMed does is we're taking that data and we're actually asking, okay, so that's great. You know, kind of throws up their hands and says lifestyle intervention's hard. No, I don't agree with that. If we incentivized it, what my company does, TrueMed, is that we actually write doctors' prescriptions for exercise and enable people to use HSA, FSA dollars, tax-free dollars to save 30, 40% on exercise. A lot more people exercise. We're hearing preliminarily that's actually dramatically improving their mental health. So you actually can prescribe and enable people to exercise and save money on that. We've all become more depressed, more overweight, all these things in the past generation. It's exploded. We can bring that back down if we incentivize the right thing. So that's what I'd say on mental health. It's just, we're totally missing the mark on just the jump to the pharmaceutical solution and not really prescribing habits. And then The expanding science on psychedelics versus SSRIs, I find very interesting. And there's hopeful FDA approval on psychedelics, which I consider a more root cause, really one-time treatment, which I think is actually very disruptive to pharma and going to be fought by pharma. But that's probably a whole nother podcast episode to talk about.
Yeah, I was on antidepressants and I asked my psychiatrist because it wasn't fully working. So he's just trying to get me on all these different antidepressant versions. And you just need to find the right one or the right dose or the pairing of multiple. And I asked him, does my diet have anything to do with it? And I was still plant-based then. He looked up and said no. And so, and I believed him because I said, okay, if my psychiatrist says no, then it's a no. And so I never considered changing my diet until I looked into keto myself and I saw all the inflammation, you know, leaky gut, leaky brain. And it got me mad. And I thought, I hope no one goes through what I went through. And that's why I started advocating, because we have the answers in front of us. But like you said, there's so much confusion out there and we don't know what to do. Then we still get fear mongered with the white lab coat syndrome, where we go to our doctors, doctors are scared of our cholesterol markers, and then we start reverting. And again, it's a lot of that confusion. And I think you brought up your company, TrueMed. It's part of the solution, but it is a question of, so what's the solution? I know we could easily change policy, but it's probably not going to happen overnight. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about your company. I know you have an upcoming book and maybe you can share that, but you know, what are some things that we could do? Obviously, we can start changing the diet within our own household, but any other ideas?
Yeah. So I've got kind of an interconnected. It's, you know, my overall mission is to change healthcare incentives. I've got the company, I've got the book, and through those, I've been doing a lot of engagement with regulators and public policy leaders. I would say actually my message is that this actually can literally change overnight. I actually do think that we missed probably the biggest opportunity for health in American history after COVID, which was a disease that preyed on weak immune systems and led to much higher rates of death in the United States, where we're metabolically healthy, than places like Japan, where they are metabolically healthy, where frankly, almost universally, if you were metabolically healthy, you didn't die of COVID. I mean, that's clear that we didn't have a national effort to reform our food system and get people moving more, which would have fortified the American population and saved trillions of dollars in downstream healthcare costs. I actually think there is a way for medical leaders to make that the center of health tomorrow, cut the subsidies to our poisonous food, stop recommending poisonous food, stop conflicts of interest in academic research, which is rampant, cut pharma spending, which is on ads, which is 70% of TV news ads, which allows them to buy off the media and our information source. It's a huge problem. Clean up the corruption. I mean, we've got a list and we're working on that. You're talking to a lot of people, but there's actually, now, I think a big thing that exists right now, which our company attacks, is the HSA FSA. So this is a big program that 80% of Americans have access to, which is great public policy. It gives you tax-free money to spend on qualified medical expenses to give you choice. What we've realized is you don't just have to save that money to when you get heart disease and have to buy the statins, have to buy all the things. You can actually, if you have a doctor's note with an intervention of exercise, healthy food, supplements, you can actually use that money to buy those metabolically healthy items. So TrueMed.com, we're working with, you know, hundreds of the leading health and wellness brands, many in the carnivore space, to seamlessly unlock tax-free spending on your favorite items. So we've got instructions on TrueMed.com on how to do that. And then after my mom's death, my sister and I, you know, really wanted to try to write and create a plan to prevent that in the future, to talk about my sister at medical school, how she had to choose at the end through to 42 specialties, segmenting the body, you know, and she chose head and neck surgery and then was going to do a fellowship and focused her entire career on 2 millimeters of the face. Which is how you rise up in medicine. That's a lie. This is totally wrong how we've segmented the body into 42 specialties. We have a different drug and different intervention for every single chronic condition. These are all related by metabolic health. And there's that is a lie being propagated on the American doctors, on American patients, that things are complicated and disaggregated. The book is about how we actually have to see the future of medicine as metabolically based, is actually a little bit more simple, frankly, than we're led to believe. And then it gives actionable tips. I think the best tips ever put to paper, thanks to my sister and a lot of allies helping us to write this book, of how to take health into your own hands, empowerment today. So that's our book, Good Energy, which is coming out in May.
That's amazing. Yeah, I think it's you bring a lot of hope to such a hard problem right now. And You know, when you said that sodas are subsidized, it makes sense. We went to Costa Rica and we noticed that the soda at the store was so much cheaper than the water. And I jokingly said to my husband, not thinking about, you know, having my nutrition hat on at that time. And I said, I should just buy soda. It's cheaper than buying water here. And then we would see all the places we would go to restaurants and all the workers were drinking soda because it was cheaper than buying bottled water. And then it hit me like they must be getting subsidized because it doesn't make sense. Like, how can water be more expensive than drinking soda? And it's rampant. It so it's insane. So where can people find you, your book, your company? I think I'm going to ask you, I'll probably talk to you offline because sometimes we can take HSA dollars or maybe it's FSA, but then sometimes we get denied because we're a nutrition company or a nutritionist and
we make it seamless.
Okay. Okay. And so
then so we are a payment integration that accepts the cards and issues the compliance. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. I'll have to talk to you offline.
We'll talk offline. Yeah.
Yeah. So share where, you know, people can learn about your company, the book that's coming and then where can people find you on social media?
That's great. The book's Good Energy, available Amazon, anywhere you buy books. Again, I really think that's I really believe Through Casey's Genius is it's a life-changing book. It's got insights that have changed my life. TrueMed.com to learn how to spend your HSA FSA dollars on root cause items. A lot of great carnivore bar and a lot of good great companies in the carnivore community. Actually, the meat mafia guys are very close with us and help us on our social media. And so you can follow TrueMed Payments on Twitter and get a lot of good content. And then I'm at Callie Means on Twitter and Instagram and talking about health incentives and really trying to, you know, push this forward from a public policy angle.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the advocacy and the work you do. I think your shock factors of like these little sound bites of things that are really happening, you know, whether it's the cost, whether it's Lunchables, the antidepressant world, a lot of your facts, it's just jarring, but it makes you wake up to, okay, maybe I don't want to listen to a lot of this content, but these are things to think about. If I'm taking a SSRI and I'm not getting better, maybe it's not the problem. Maybe it's not the root cause solution. And I know people will say, well, diet's so hard to change. We need to fix something about obesity too. Like that's the argument I hear. Well, we need to give kids something so that they don't die. And so then the solution becomes Ozempic, but we have to fix the root cause issue because if this problem doesn't go away, this country will be over. And I don't think people really understand that. So thank you so much for your advocacy.
Thank you. Thank you. We're all on a journey. And I think more knowledge about this stuff is the first step to empowerment and really appreciate the conversation.
Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed this interview. I learned so much about corruption, even beyond the things that I knew. And I hope you learned a lot more too. We are against a big Goliath or a big behemoth that is much bigger than us. But if we don't do something to change it, it will affect all of us. It will affect this country. And in learning this information, instead of getting disheartened or what's the point, it shouldn't be that way. But now that we have this knowledge, we have the empowerment to help the others around us. If every single person affected one other person to kind of open their eyes and understand, hey, maybe you taking the pharma medications isn't the best and maybe eating a different way can actually more benefit you. And if we share that with one person and that one person shares it with another, the effects are huge. And that is why we cannot give up as people in trying to change the big things that are against us, because there's a lot. I also think that we have to take a moment in our wellness space and not always just fight one another, because in the bigger picture, we are fighting the same big Goliath or behemoth. And so when we get nuanced with calories in, calories out, or this food is bad or this food is good, yes, those nuances actually do matter in the wellness space. And if you are chronically ill, but if we can actually work a little bit more closer together, we will realize that we are fighting the same big enemy that has got us here in the first place to even have these types of debates. I hope you guys enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Make sure to check out Callie and Dr. Casey Means' new book because it shares a lot of the information that Callie shared today on my podcast. All right, guys, you know the drill. Make sure to eat a lot of meat. Take care of your bodies because it is the only place you have to live. I will talk to you later. Bye, guys. Thanks for listening to the Nutrition with Judy podcast. If you liked what you heard today, please make sure to leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app so more listeners like you can find the show. If you want more practitioner care and support, head over to nutritionwithjudy.com/groups so you can get more real talk about carnivore, the environment, and root cause healing. You can also find my content on Nutrition with Judy's YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Make sure to sign up for my weekly newsletter and learn more about in-depth articles with infographics at nutritionwithjudy.com/articles. You can find my two books, Carnivore Cure and The Complete Carnivore Diet for Beginners, on carnivorecure.com and amazon.com. At the heart of Nutrition with Judy's practice, our mission lies with a deep, unwavering passion for service and community. We will continue to empower you to have the knowledge and tools to live a life nearly symptom-free, because we firmly believe in healing and wellness for all.